But tonight, I'm really happy to welcome to Many Rivers Books and Tea David Parker. He teaches Tai Chi and Qigong here in Sebastopol at the dance space down the street.
In the park in the summertime.
And he will be talking about healing without medicines in Chinese medicine. So thank you very much for coming tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. And thank you all for coming as well. It's nice to see quite a few familiar and all friendly faces out in the audience. And I'd also like to thank the folks at Many Rivers who are making this possible. I am here tonight to introduce the idea of healing without medicines in Chinese medicine and Dr. Xiepei Qi. Dr. Xiepei Qi was a gentleman born in 1920. He died in 2003, so he is no longer with us. But he was a Chinese medicine practitioner, a martial arts lineage holder, a practitioner of what's called Dao Yin, what we know nowadays as Qigong or Qi development exercise. And he's also quite an interesting character all the way around, a very unique man. I think I will back up a little bit. I will introduce what I do for a living and let that segue into how I met Dr. Xie. And then I'll start talking a little bit about him, and then we'll get into what I'm going to talk about tonight, which is basically trying to set a context or kind of give you some information, some background information that will on him, of course, on his practices, on the conditions of the times in China in the last 150 years, and what it is to be a traditional practitioner, so-called, versus a modern practitioner. And as you'll see, we're going to make that definition be the point of time that the communist government took over in China. But Jim introduced me nicely. My name is David Parker. I know most of you, which is great. For those that I don't, I live here in Sebastopol. I've been here about 10 years now, almost. I am a body worker and a Chinese medicine practitioner. I have a little business called Integrative Body Works, also in Sebastopol here. And I specialize in an energy body work style of Chinese medicine that came from Dr. Xie's system. Also acupressure, and massage therapy, Western massage therapy as well. I do practice Qigong and teach that. I also practice some martial arts. In the past, I practiced more Tai Chi Xuan, and now I've sort of gone over to the dark side of Bagua Zhang, which is just another Chinese martial art. I finally followed Dr. Xie in that route. When I met him, I was studying medicine with him and qi cultivation, and his martial arts were a little bit too much for me, but I managed to come along after a while. Anyway, I began practicing massage therapy in Colorado in 1984. It was a seasonal kind of situation. I lived up in the mountains in ski country and had the opportunity to start doing a little body work in the wintertime there for skiers. After a couple of years, I decided I was very interested in pursuing bodywork as a craft, and I did some formal training, took school training under Dr. Mark Manton of the Massage Therapy Institute of Colorado for a year in 1986 and 1987. He was the one who introduced me to Tai Chi and also to Chinese medicine, particularly acupuncture, which is the most well-known branch of Chinese medicine. I had the opportunity a year later to begin a two-year clinical apprenticeship in Chinese medicine under an American acupuncturist. And that was 1988 to 1990. I finished that and started to add that into my bodywork practice. In the mid-1990s, 1995, I went down to Boulder to do a workshop with Andrew Nugent Head, an American young man who had been in China for a number of years at that time. He went over when he was 18 years old. And he went over specifically to study China's traditional arts and find practitioners of them, especially in the martial arts. He had come to the United States that year bringing Professor Wang Jinhui with him, who was a calligrapher and a scholar of Chinese medicine. He was not a doctor himself, but his parents had been and his grandparents had been doctors. And he had been passed down a style of body work that was a bit unique, and that's what I went down for. I was also interested in talking to Andrew about his Tai Chi teacher, who my Tai Chi teacher was interested in, a gentleman in China. So I went down and I met Professor Wang and I met Andrew and asked him about his Tai Chi teacher. And he said, well, yes, I can tell you a little bit about him, but I'm not studying with him anymore. I found this Bagua practitioner. And I'm going to bring him back next year. You really ought to come back and meet this guy. So I filed that away, and next year I went back and met Andrew and Dr. Xie. Dr. Xie, there are lots of stories about the doctor. As I say, he was quite a character, and I will. I'm not going to tell too many, but I'll start out with one. When a friend of mine and I walked into this workshop, the room where they were going to be having it, and there were a few people sitting around, and there was a small and rather odd-looking Chinese man sitting across the room very quietly in a chair, just looking around at everybody. And people were filtering in and sitting down, and some 20-somethings came in and sat down on the floor and proceeded to haul themselves up into half lotuses with some difficulty, and the doctor, who's 76 years old, is looking around. And after a minute, he doesn't say a word, but he slips out of his chair onto the ground and easily folds his legs into a full lotus with both feet pointing up, and then lays down on his back, and with his knees, of course, still flat on the floor. And then everybody got everybody's attention, and then he proceeded to bridge up onto his knees and up onto his shoulders, pull his dantian, his belly, a good foot off the ground, and hold that for a minute or so. And then slowly let himself back down and sit back up and looked around, and all these people are sitting there and their jaws open and going, what is this all about? And he says something in Chinese, and Andrew, who's taking care of something, setting up the workshop, looks over and says, oh, he apologizes. He hasn't been practicing this much lately. He apologizes for not being able to bridge up onto the top of his head in that posture. So, as I say, that made me think, well, this is somebody I need to find out a little bit more about. That weekend, he presented a little bit of his martial arts and a little bit of his medicine and a little bit of his qi cultivation, and I felt his hands landing on me in rapid succession when he was demonstrating a martial technique, mercifully emptied of the force that he could have put into them, but still quite impressive. And I felt this incredible warmth coming out of his hands when he put his hands on you to do some body work. It was like warm liquid honey started moving inside your body, and nothing going on in the outside, just his hands there. He was touching. And again, that made me think, this is somebody I want to check out, because in my own work at that time, I was kind of running up against some of the physical limitations of massage therapy. There's only so hard you can push physically and so much you can do that way. I wanted to continue and continue to practice, and I also wanted to have a set of hands that worked when I was 60 or 70 years old. So I was looking for some sort of an energy bodywork style or some way of working smarter and not so hard. And I decided for me, I was interested in Chinese medicine and already practicing a little bit, that I was interested in what Dr. Xie had to say. So that's how I met him. His particular art is called Yin Style Bagua. I'll talk a little bit more later about what Bagua means and where that comes from. I'm also going to be talking about Yin and Yang, terms we've heard and concepts that we may be more or less familiar with. And I'll just point out that this Yin Style Bagua does not refer to that Yin and Yang. It's rather a family name. It's named after a man named Yin Fu, much like the Yang style Tai Chi that's practiced widely in the world today is not the Yang of Yin and Yang, but also a family name. So that's interesting and something people don't always know. As I say, and excuse me, I haven't lectured like this for a while, so I'll probably be referring to my notes a little bit here, make sure I get to tell you everything that I would like to tell you. Dr. Xie was a lineage carrier in his line of Yin-style Bagua, fourth generation practitioner from a man named Dong Haichuan, who invented or developed the art in the mid-1800s. As martial arts goes, it's a fairly young art, but it's based on the Bagua and the I Ching, that is the philosophy that underpins Chinese culture and has a history of 3,000 to 5,000 years. So the philosophy that the art of Yin-style Bagua is based on is 3,000 to 5,000 years old, depending on who you ask, and is really the basis of Chinese culture. It's the philosophy of Yin and Yang, and then of the trigrams, which is the Bagua. And we'll be talking about that a bit later. But as an art, it's fairly young. Taiji Xuan, likewise, based on the philosophy of the Taiji, or Yin and Yang, which also goes back at least 3,000 years, well, really as far as the Bagua and the I Ching, but as an art older than Bagua, but still only about 20 generations old. So the idea that there are arts based on these philosophical frameworks. The art of Yin-style Bagua included martial arts, qi cultivation, what we call qigong, and what Dr. Xie called Dao Yin. It also included Chinese medicine, a bodywork healing system, acupuncture, herbal medicine, and the qigong or qi development work. Specifically, we're going to be looking at, over the next couple of weeks, a video of a lecture that Dr. Xie gave the second time that he was in the United States in 1997. The title of that tour was Healing Without Medicines, and that was what this particular lecture was about. So we might consider here to start out with what is healing without medicines? What does that refer to? In general, healing without medicines is just what it sounds like. It's using other methods of treatment besides herbs and pharmaceuticals. In Chinese medicine, it would be more herbal medicine that they're talking about, but this idea includes the West. So for us, it's methods of healing that do not include taking medicine. Also, there's an aspect of self-treatment within the idea of healing without medicines. So while acupuncture, for instance, is not using medicines, it's generally not practiced on ourselves. An acupuncturist can needle themselves, but most of the rest of us wouldn't probably want to do that. So healing without medicines in Chinese medicine refers to, as I said, what we call qigong, and various other ways of dealing with our bodies, self-massage, things like padding, striking, manipulating the body in different ways, shaking the body. All of these things, as Dr. Xie will point out and talk about, and I'm going to do my best not to overlap too much with my talk, what he's going to be talking about next week. But he would talk about all these things, and he especially liked padding and shaking, which he said were things that came from instinctive things that humans and animals did, and then were slowly systematized, turned into, organized into systems of information rather than being just sort of random things. The same thing with sounds. He used sounds in healing within qigong. But an example, for instance, the kind of thing we're talking about is if a child, for instance, was outside in the wintertime and got their hands frostbitten or cold, he'd come in and he'd be unhappy, and the mother would take the hand and go, like that to warm it up. You know, a very obvious thing, just something any of us would do. Well, the people studied that over time and decided that this ha sound that the mother makes instinctively is a sound that is coming from the heart, physically from the heart organ inside us. And in Chinese medicine, the heart deals with fire and with heating and cooling in the body to a great degree. So this ha sound that we use instinctively, they paired with the organ of the heart and turned into an exercise that you could use to benefit the heart, to strengthen it, to flow its qi, to disperse it if it was needed. On the other hand, if a child burned his hand or fell and scraped it, the mother would go like this and use a different type of breath that was very cooling. If you try that yourself, it's the same breath, but one is very warm, obviously, the other cooling. So they took something like that and turned it into, systematized it, looked at how it worked, tried to fit it into an organized exercise, added other things to it that would increase its efficiency, and turned it into a healing without medicines method. So these are the sort of things and how they developed. Animals, for instance, and humans used to be much more adept at, again, falling down, hurting yourself, patting the area, doing something like this, rubbing it. You know, these things we don't think of as unusual because they're things we instinctively do. But these doctors and practitioners took these things, as they say, organized them, made them much more potent. And that's what that's the kind of thing that falls under healing without medicines. It also includes such things as heat treatments, using mud baths, any kind of external treatment like that that doesn't involve taking medicines internally. But most specifically, it's qigong and patting, shaking methods, self-massage, things like that. So the healing without medicines video. Okay, we've talked about this a little bit. Qigong, massage of all types, light, sound, heat and cold, mud, etc. Within Yin-style Bagua, as a art system, it has several types of Qigong sets. One called the Eight Healing Sounds, one called the Eight Storing Qi and Developing Sensitivity Exercises, one called the 12 Seated Guiding and Leading Qi Meditations, the Luohan Padding System, which is the system that was derived from, that started out with just padding an area that you've bruised, turned it into a system that takes an hour or more to cover your whole body with padding, or that a doctor or somebody who is trained could use specifically for injuries or illnesses of certain types. There's also a complete shaking system, of standing or sitting and shaking the body in different ways. A very powerful system, something that doesn't seem like much until you start to practice it and find out what it can do for you. It also includes body work. There's a very highly developed system of energy body work within Yin-style Bagua, and it's a system that you can use to treat yourself with. And then there are various and miscellaneous kind of health maintenance exercises, particular things for our eyes and nose and mouth cavities and teeth and ears and so forth and so on, kind of miscellaneous things. So that's what's inside of Yin-style Bagua in terms of healing without medicines. And again, a lot of what Dr. Xie will be talking about in the video over the next couple of weeks. Tonight's talk, to set, as I say, kind of set the stage and provide some context for understanding what Dr. Xie is talking about, we're going to be looking at the origins and current meanings of a few key terms that are part of the core basis of the Bagua and the I Ching and Chinese culture and all of the Chinese arts. The three characters that we're going to look at are Yin and Yang and Qi, terms that I'm sure everybody here has heard of, but it's sort of interesting at how we look at them for meanings. The old meanings, we look at the characters themselves and break down the meanings of the pictographs and to get an idea of what they were talking about. For modern usage, we're going to use the dictionary. And sometimes there are surprises there, and sometimes it's just about what you expect. We'll then look at what I call the traditional cosmology of the Tao, as explained by Lao Tzu, who's the semi-legendary gentleman who wrote the Tao Te Ching. This is a book that comes in many, many forms and translations. This is a Stephen Mitchell translation that I particularly like. This bookstore undoubtedly, probably has a dozen or so different translations. But this, along with the I Ching, is kind of the setting forth of the basis, again, of Chinese culture. And Lao Tzu, in a couple of chapters of this book, really lays out very succinctly, how the Tao is perceived to have come into existence in the world, and that includes everything from heaven above to earth below, and then everything else, us included. So we're going to look at how that came into being, and then we will consider what is a traditional practitioner. How do we define this? How are they different than a modern practitioner? And finally, we will look at the timeline of China's history in the last 150 years or so, and see how that might impact the lives or what the times were like for these people who are traditional practitioners. What were the implications for them and for Chinese medicine in particular over this time period? A time of great change in China and tremendous upheaval, as we'll see. So I think this is going to kind of come in a couple of sections, and the part on yin yang and qi, and then the cosmology of the Tao, is a little technical. I think it's going to be understandable, but we'll maybe have some time for some questions if anybody has any on those parts. And then I'll continue to talk a little bit more about the traditional practitioners and Dr. Xie and his times. And then if there are any more questions, we'll talk about those at the end. If we're lucky and I don't talk too much, maybe we'll even practice a little bit at the end. So I have a feeling most people have seen this picture before. We tend to call this the yin-yang symbol. In China, this is called the Taiji, or the Taiji map. And Taiji refers to yin and yang. And the idea is that this is a map of the laws of yin and yang. And everything about how yin and yang behave and everything about yin and yang can be derived from looking at this picture. This is not the only one of these that's in existence. This is an older version of it. And you can see that it has certain similarities. It has the black and white portions. This does not have the dot in the center of its opposite color. But both of them give the idea of movement and of transformation and change, which are certainly key elements of the Taiji. And we'll get back to that and talk about that a little bit more later on. We're going to look at the characters for yin and yang and qi. And I have a handout here for you. We'll just pass these around. Here to make it all the way around, I think. And as I say, we're going to start out by looking at the older versions of the characters and their composite parts, and figuring out some of the meanings from that. I'm curious, do people have any ideas before looking at this sheet too much about what yin and yang are? Yeah. Oh, you do? Okay. And what would that be? No. So, no, I won't make you try and tell me about what yin and yang are, but please, no, a lot, yeah. A lot of people have heard. Masculine and feminine, yes, very, very much so. And I'll actually, I'll wait and do this in the order I have it set out. I'm going to talk about some laws of yin and yang, and that will help to define. You need some more back there?
Okay.
So first the first line at the top of the first page are two characters that represent yin. I'll mention that there are older, there are many styles of calligraphy in China. From ancient times, the earliest calligraphy were pictographs. And they were pictures, they just drew pictures of things, and they were very easily recognizable. Over time, they become more stylized, and through the thousands of years, there were many styles of writing. These are both modern forms of characters. The character on the left for yin is the older style, the more complicated kind of character, and it has a lot richer meaning. The communists decided, among other things, to simplify the characters. They thought the characters were too complicated for people, so they rewrote a lot of the characters, and there's a whole set of simplified Chinese characters that are more commonly now used in mainland China. The nationalists who left when the communists arrived, and we'll be going over this history a bit later too, mostly fled to Taiwan, and they took the older language with them, and that's where primarily the old style characters are still used. They are also still used in China, and scholars especially are interested in them, but the more modern characters are in general usage. We'll find out that the older style characters are a lot more fun. So anyway, two characters for yin. And the meaning, the traditional meaning of yin is hillside or hills or mountains, and vapor, steam, or mist. Those are the parts of the character. So most, if not all, I will put out a disclaimer here. I'm not a speaker of Chinese. I have a limited vocabulary around Chinese medicine and qi cultivation and martial arts, but I can't really put sentences together. So also my pronunciation is probably terrible, but I'm going to do the best that I can with this. There's a portion of a Chinese character that's called a radical, and that's a Western word, and it generally means root, and that's actually not the best term for it. But radical is actually a way of, among other things, looking up Chinese characters in the dictionary. It makes it much easier to look them up because you look up a character according to its radical. It makes it a lot easier to scan through thousands and thousands of characters if they're broken down into sections of radicals. There are 200 and something radicals. Anyway, that's not our topic here. The radical in the character for yin is the stick on the left with the, it looks like a B to the right of it. And down below on the third line, I've broken that out. And that character on its own is the character Fu, and it means a place. When it's used in yin and yang, it takes on the meaning of a mountain or a hillside. The second part of the yin character in the old style also has two parts, an upper part and a lower part. The lower part represents a steam or a mist or a vapor, clouds rising. And the upper part, which is the little roof with the mark underneath it and then the one line that goes like that, is a phonetic character. That's what gives this character its pronunciation of yin. The radicals, one of the things the radicals do is sometimes they provide pronunciation, sometimes they provide meaning for the word, sometimes they act as both and sometimes as neither. But usually the radical either provides a pronunciation or meaning for the character. In the case of yin, it provides part of the meaning. In any event, I put down in the simplified form of the character on the right, that mist and the character yin that gives it its name are replaced by the moon. So in the simplified character, you have that place or hillside and a moon. So the derivation from the classical meaning is the shady side of a valley. If anybody's lived in the mountains, and especially lived in a valley that ran east and west, the north side, the north facing and the south facing, or the sunny side and the shady side of that valley are quite different. The shady side has big trees on it. You get in those trees and it's cool. The mists hang in those trees and it tends to be damp as well. It tends to also be dark. All of these things are yin characteristics. Jumping ahead a little bit, when you're over on the sunny side of that same valley, just across the valley, it may be very spare for vegetation, may have some sagebrush on it, and it's going to be quite a bit hotter. Of course, the sun is going to be shining, and it's going to be dry, and maybe dusty. All of these things are more yang in nature. So they used this original derivation of a place, in particular a hillside, and vapor, steam, or mist, or clouds, to designate the meaning of yin. And that's the classical meaning of it, we might say. If we look it up in the dictionary today, what we find is female, female principle, dark, mysterious, and secret. And, you know, dark does not carry any negative connotation. It's simply dark, unknown, dark versus light as well. But also the idea of mysterious and secret. If something is in the dark, it's hard to perceive. So those are the meanings that we find if we look that word up in the dictionary. And these are general meanings. Within Chinese medicine, these things take on slightly more technical meanings. And we'll touch on that as well. If we look at the next character for yang, and yang is a great character, and I'm going to break this one down all the way. First, I'll just point out that the simplified version on the right again has the radical fu for place, which helps us to look it up. And then very simply the character, the modern character for sun. So you have a place and you have sun. On the traditional character on the left, the more complicated one, you have the fu radical. And then the piece on the right is actually four separate characters. I'm going to have to look at my notes for this one. So, breaking down yang, we have fu for place. Then the whole right side of that character is yang. And that is, again, gives it the pronunciation. That is all. The whole character is called yang, and the right-hand portion of it is called yang as well. And that yang means sun appearing, rays piercing clouds like pennants. And you know, I think that's just a great image. It's a bit of an example of the richness of meaning that can be held in a Chinese character. It's not just that it's the sun or in a valley. It's the sun beginning to appear and piercing the clouds, opening the clouds and shooting down rays through it like pennants. Pennants meaning banners. This character on the right we can break down further. And that lower part is wu, and that is the three or four lines that are coming down to the left and the single line. And that wu is a pictograph of banners on a pole used to direct troops. And all of these things, another great thing about this, remember, as was pointed out, yang is the male principle versus female. It's one of the most common meanings. So all of these things, the sun's rays piercing the clouds, you know, banners being taken into battle, all very kind of masculine things or masculine-oriented. It breaks down even further than that. So the upper part of the character, the sun character there and the straight line, those two together are called dan. And that's the sun rising above the horizon, or dawn. Breaking down that character, it's the sun above, and then the character yi, the single horizontal line, which is the character for one, as in one, two, three. But in usage, it usually means a horizon line. If it's placed at the top of the character, it'll indicate heaven, usually. So in this one character here, We have a place. We have a valley. We have the sun rising and its rays shooting down through the clouds. We have the idea of banners being carried into battle. We have the sun, again, the sun rising over the horizon. We have just the sun, and then we have just the horizon. All of these things within this one pictograph. And that gives us, or gave them, a feeling of what is Yang, what's it about. It's about all those things. So, to boil that down, it's a hillside, and the sun's rays shining down are just the sunny side of the valley. When we look it up in the dictionary, it's the male principle, brightness, or the sun. Fairly straightforward, and these are kind of things we expect to find. And, you know, so they say male and male principle, and I think of male principle as it can refer to the sexual essence, both of the male and the female, that aspect. And it can also just refer to maleness and femaleness, you know, female qualities like nurturing, receiving, male qualities like activating, you know, going out and doing things. And of course, we run the risk of oversimplifying and stereotyping, and we don't want to do that. We don't want to take it that far. But these are our indications, and this is how, you know, how the language is put together. So the next character down is Qi. And here we get a little more surprises when we look at the definitions. First, the old style version of Qi, a newer style, the modern character for Qi, and then an ancient character for Qi, which I just put in there because that came from a reputable source. I tried to look up that character, but I couldn't find much information on it. But three possibilities for Qi there. Now, Qi, when... We'll look at the radical first. The radical for Qi is also Qi. It's right below it, and you can see what part of it is. And it means to disperse like air or steam. The other part of the character, on the traditional character, is the character Mi, which is the character for rice, or a grain, but specifically rice, which is the grain that nurtures China. So a very important thing for them. To break down that character Mi for rice, it has a cross like this in the middle of it, which can be looked at as the compass points, the four directions. And then there's a grain of rice in each of the corners of the compass points. So we have the compass points, all four directions, which means everywhere, and we have rice in each of the corners of the compass. So some of the things you can derive from that, or ways of looking at that, are that qi could be something that is formless, nourishing, and everywhere, which is a lot of the characteristics of qi. It's out here all around us. It's inside us. We can't put our hands on it. It has no form. it's nourishing. It provides for us. And it's everywhere, which is a fortunate thing. It can also be looked at as an invisible force that performs work, if we look at it more as a steam rather than a vapor. All of these things, all of these meanings can be held within the character, again, just looking at the individual parts of the character. Now, when we look up qi in the dictionary, first of all, if you haven't looked at this too much yet, what would people say about qi? Anybody have a definition of qi for me, or what we think of it as?
Energy.
Energy is one. Life force is another that we hear a lot, especially as applied to us as humans. Vital energy is another. In fact, if you ask most people, certainly in the West, that's what they'll tell you. When we look it up in the dictionary, the first definition is air or gas. The second definition is going to be the other one of those two. After that, you'll get steam, breath, smell, odor, weather, tian qi, it's heaven's qi, that's the weather, airs, somebody's, you know, the airs somebody has, their being or their manner, which is the next definition. Spirit, make angry, get angry, bully, insult. So these are all the first definitions of qi when you look it up in the dictionary. So you're going, what's this all about?
I always heard that it was also called breath.
Right, and that is one of the definitions here that you run into in the dictionary. And I'll explain that a little bit in just a minute.
The question is this in a Chinese dictionary?
Yes. If you look this word up in the Chinese dictionary, or in our case, a Chinese-American dictionary, these are the definitions that you'll get. Then down at definition number 9 or 10, you'll see Chinese medicine, specialized usage, vital energy, energy of life. So for an average non-technical Chinese, when you say qi, they're going to think air or gas. And, you know, if they know something about medicine or they've had acupuncture and heard a doctor talk, well, then maybe they'll think this life force. But they're going to think a lot of other things first, including breath. Now, if qi is air, we take air into our bodies with breath. Our lungs have the very fortunate ability to extract the useful part of air that we need in our bodies and extract that from the air. So that's qi. And that's why qi is often thought of as breath. Because breath is the process of taking qi or air into our body and extracting the part of it that's useful for us, and then sending it around to be circulated in our system. So breath is very much associated with qi. There are also are other characters, and as I mentioned, qi is not a physical object. It is tangible. And that, I'll go back now to Dr. Xie, is one of the greatest gifts of his practice. Is that his practice is all about making qi tangible, taking this theoretical and very impermanent idea and turning it into something that we can feel and identify in our bodies. So qi can be made to be tangible, but it's not a physical object. We actually feel qi according to its activities in our body. I'm going to get back to that in a little bit too. A couple other characters that have been used for qi over the years. One is hua, which is fire. That was used in the pre-Tang Dynasty times, which is around 600 AD or so. A very different looking character. And then the character yang, which its meaning, its direct meaning is sheep, interestingly. But it's also been used for qi. I don't know if the sheep was considered to be a particularly qi-full animal or not. Oftentimes combined into this character, yang, meaning oxygen. And that's a little more obvious to us, as we've talked about air and what we extract from air. We think of it as oxygen. Chinese, it would be qi. Also, the very earliest, and I think this is kind of cool too, the very earliest ancient character for qi looked like this. So it was three wavy lines. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot about what it is. Because that's, more and more, that's part of how I understand it today, as a frequency, as a vibration, you know, that we may or may not be able to directly feel, but that's moving around us, moving through us, moving inside us, and has this, you know, has a flowing movement. Also, just out of interest, I'll see if I can write this character. This is also an ancient character. Won't be really too good, I don't think. But this is an ancient character for an acupuncture point. Shows the point surrounded by an area and then the same qi flowing underneath it. Okay. So Chinese culture is based on the philosophy of yin and yang. there are some rules for yin and yang. This yin and yang is also known as the Taiji, as I've said. It's also known as the Tao. And it's set forth in the Yi Jing, which is the, we call the Book of Changes, the Classic of Changes is maybe a little bit better title for it, and the Tao Te Ching, this book that I mentioned, the Classic of the Tao. The philosophy of yin and yang set forth in these books. I'll also make a note here, talking about the modern meanings and usage in the dictionary. We've gone over the dictionary meanings for these words. This is just a side note. The difference between a classical Chinese dictionary and a modern Chinese dictionary. A modern Chinese dictionary is a lot like our dictionaries. You look up a word and it gives you definitions. Classical Chinese dictionary uses syntax, uses how the words are put together into sentences for meaning. And the syntax comes from the classic books. So if you looked up a word in a classic Chinese dictionary, you'd get passages out of the Tao Te Ching and passages using that word out of the I Ching. And you get your meaning from the context and syntax of those classic books. Part of that is because, especially in the old days, China was a pretty illiterate society. But scholars had read and memorized these few classic books. And so they were constantly referring to each other, and in definitions of words and searching for meanings, they would use the classic meanings coming from these texts. Okay, let's... I mentioned also that in medical and qi cultivation use, qi is tangible but not an object, and that it's often named for its activities, its functions, and its location. So thus in the body and medicine use, and this is again the sort of thing that we're a little more used to hearing, we have things like organ qi and meridian qi. Qi that's in a particular organ or in a particular meridian, a place. We have defensive qi and nutritive qi. That's the activities of qi. Qi can defend the body from, you know, colds coming in from the outside. It can nurture the body from inside. So it's activities. Stagnant qi and flowing qi, the activities of qi. And when we have flowing qi, we generally don't feel it too much. That's a nice feeling, or it feels very pleasant. Stagnant qi is what we generally consider to be pain, so that we do notice. So we notice qi according to its activities and what it's doing with us. Rising qi and sinking qi, direction of movement. So these are just a couple examples of how qi is defined. And notice the pairs, the yin-yang pairs and relationships. So that brings us, on the second page of these notes, to the laws of yin and yang, which I just want to go over briefly, again, get a little more of an understanding, and this was touched on to begin with. There are five laws of yin and yang, and this comes from medicine. Everything in the world has a yin and a yang aspect. So remember the picture here. It's complete only when there's both the black and the white. So everything has both yin and yang. They exist only in relationship to each other. They're never absolute. Even if you cut this in half in a way that is mostly black, there's a little bit of white showing. So it's never all one or all the other. They always have to contain the other one and exist only in relationship with each other. So each thing has a yin and yang aspect. Each of these aspects can be further divided into yin and yang, and that continues infinitely, in theory anyway. Yin and yang depend on or create each other. Yin and yang control each other. So this is setting up a homeostatic system. And in the human body, of course, we want to maintain an even level of function. So yin and yang want to be moving all the time, changing into each other, creating each other, so that we grow and develop. But they also want to keep tabs or check each other, keep one from running out of control. So they both create and control each other. And finally, yin and yang transform into each other, also indicated quite well in both of these. The white is yang, the black is yin. Down here, yin is very small. It grows and grows and grows until it gets very large, and then it starts transforming into, or I'm sorry, yang is growing, it starts transforming into yin. As it diminishes, yin grows. That transformation takes place, then yin grows and grows and grows until it's full, it starts to diminish, and it transforms into yang. Again, one feeding the other in a continuous cycle. That's about it. Are you okay? And this is important, and this is where complexity comes in, because so far it's fairly simple. Yin and yang transform into each other, and the rate of this transformation is constantly changing. And it, excuse me, it can be harmonious or not harmonious. And I'm going to leave this pretty much at this, because I don't want to end up only getting through half my material. But these are the laws of yin and yang, and this is what also helps to define it for us, define them for us, and the idea of the Taiji and their relationship. So yin and yang are concerned with relationship, pattern, and change. As I said, they can only exist in relation to each other, and they cannot be absolute. Okay, we talked about the wavy lines. With qi, we've noticed there's quite a difference between general usage and technical usage in medicine and qi cultivation. And interestingly, qi is part of hundreds of words, because words are made up of multiple characters. There's another whole talk there that I won't go into right now. But a few of the words, a few hundred words, use the character qi, including such things as pneumatic jackhammers and gasoline. So there are some things kind of associated with qi that we would not expect necessarily, but you know, we know the idea of air and pressurized air, and that's where the pneumatic jackhammers come from, and gasoline, something that burns and produces energy. Yeah, all these things. In medical and qi cultivation use, qi is tangible but not an object. Okay, we talked about that. Functions of qi in the body. I'm going to talk about qi here briefly and then move on to the cosmology of the Tao. There are five functions of qi in the body, and I'm just going to list them, not talk about them too much, but you can consider these as we go along. Qi is the source of and accompanies all movement. So qi creates my movement, and when I lift my arm, qi also follows that movement, yin and yang. Always yin and yang. Yin and yang is the world that this is all about. Qi protects the body and defends it. It lives in the skin and keeps pernicious influences, such as cold and damp, heat and dryness, out of our bodies. It protects us at the skin level. It also protects us at a very deep level of immunity inside. Qi is the root of harmonious transformation in the body. Qi retains and supports the body's substances and organs, holds things together. That's a good way of putting it. And qi keeps us warm. It warms us up from inside. So, any particular confusions or questions that come up from this so far? Okay.
I wonder what that means.
Oh, you know, and that's a nice question, and I will come back to that actually just here momentarily.
My question, yeah, is about the companion book to the Tao Te Ching, Changzu.
Oh, Chuangzu.
It's, I consider it a lesser book, but what do you have to
say? Chuangzu is a student of Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu is a semi-legendary character. Chuangzu is a real person. He was a student of Lao Tzu. He looked at Lao Tzu, and he wrote many books, or a few anyway. He looked at Lao Tzu and said, oh, man, this is esoteric. People are not going to understand this. So I'm going to illustrate this with stories that people can understand. So he wrote stories to illustrate the ideas that were put forth a bit more esoterically in the Tao Te Ching. So that's kind of how I look at Chuang Tzu and Lao Tzu.
Because I resonate with that and not so much with the other.
More with the Tao?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's different things for different people. Some people, you know, go right for the, you know, that kind of spare and philosophical meaning. For some people, it's easier to understand when put into more real-life situations. So that's what Chuang Tzu did. And he also, Chuang Tzu was a guy who would just get you on board with him and his ideas going one way, and then he would make a 90-degree right turn and just pull the carpet out from underneath you. He was very good at keeping you from getting too complacent. So, the origin of all things, the cosmology of the Tao. Let's look at the two little excerpts that I took from the Tao Te Ching on this page of the handouts. The origin of all things. First, there are the first verse, and this is very classic. You've probably heard this before. It's quoted a lot. First verse of chapter 42. The Tao creates or gives birth to the One. The One creates the Two. The Two create the Three. The Three create the 10,000 things. And if you look at the next page of the notes, the cosmology of the Tao, they've given kind of a graphic or two graphic representations of what this refers to. First of all, it says, in a more literal translation, the Tao creates the Tao. And that makes us look at the other line that I quoted here, which is the very first line from the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. And what that means is that the Tao is so mysterious and so big and so small that we can't begin to understand it. We can't even talk about it. As soon as we mention its name, it's no longer the same thing. And that's what that is saying. And yet, he goes on to say, but of course we have to talk about it. And we have to try and figure it out and discern it. And I made a mental note when, some number of years ago, I read that physics, some branch of physics, maybe quantum physics, had found out that when an experiment is observed by a human being, the result is different than when it's not observed. And that made me think, interesting. The Tao, as soon as we talk about it, it's no longer the Tao. So, going over to the cosmology of the Tao, that's something you can think about a little bit. A couple of different representations, and I think that this one on the right is more of the traditional view. And first we have this state called Wuji, and what I've shown for that is nothing. And that's the Tao that we can't talk about. So we can't even see it. It's nothing. It creates itself. The Tao creates or gives birth to the One. Now it's the empty circle, undifferentiated. And this is the Tao with a small d versus the Tao with a big D. And that's what's here in the center of this diagram to answer your question.
What is?
This is the Tao. This is the undifferentiated Tao.
Oh, I see.
Right here. It's this circle that's empty. Mm-hmm. It's also called the Hundun. And the guy who painted this, I don't know if he knew or not, but it is generally colored kind of an egg yolk color in the old, an egg yolk color, not white in the old diagram. So this is actually quite accurate. So we have the Tao creates the One. The Tao that we can't speak of creates the Tao that we can speak of. The One creates the Two. This undifferentiated space, something changes and it separates into yin and yang. And this is called the Taiji. This Wuji is the empty state, emptiness, thing of none. Yaoji here means you begin a thought. Taiji means it separates into yin and yang, and yin and yang begin to move. So we have the Tao creates the One create the Two. The Two create the Three. And what I've shown here is one of the trigrams of the Bagua to represent the three. But in between here, we've put down the three, the classic threes that you see in the texts are heaven, mankind, and earth. Or man, woman, and child. Or man, child, and woman. Or in the body, what's called spirit, chi, and essences. These are classic level three things. It also does refer to the trigrams, of which this is one. They're the three-lined diagrams that put together with another one make up the hexagrams, and that's what we look up in the I Ching. So that's a good representation of what the three is. And then the three create the 10,000 things, or the many or all things. And I couldn't help but quote Douglas Adams here, life, the universe, and everything. So from the three, we derive all phenomena. And when you think about heaven, earth, and man, or man, woman, and child, you can understand how those three things come together and create all phenomena. This is the way this is looked at. Briefly, the other side here, just a little different representation that's also worth looking at. We have the one, the Tao, the undifferentiated up here at the top, creates the one, which is the Taiji, which is not separated yet. The one creates the two, yin and yang separate, and then yin and yang come back together and form the three, and the three create the 10,000 things.
And when did when was the changeover in transliteration between the Tao with a T and Tao with a T?
Okay. Well, that's another... that's another story too, but basically that happened in fairly modern times, kind of communist era also. Okay. My notes here, it's the things that I have already talked about. Okay, the three. Also, the three, again, represent yin and yang and complexity. Yin and yang on their own, not too difficult to understand. Opposing complementary phenomena. Man and woman, or male and female. Light and dark. Activity, passivity. That's not too hard to understand. The three starts to introduce the complexity of all things. Because another way of looking at the three is, and this, you'll have to bear with me on this, I can't explain it too much because it would take some time, but it's yin plus yang plus yin and yang. And that yin and yang can come in varying balances. So this starts to bridge the way into the 10,000 things, which are the myriad representations of yin and yang. Any questions on this?
Spirit, chi, essences.
Okay, that is three, in a way, that's three states of chi in our body. And many things come in threes in Chinese thinking and Chinese medicine. Jing, Qi, and Shen are the words in Chinese. I kind of think of it as three states of H2O, ice, water, and water vapor. Jing, or essences, are Qi that is stored in our body for use later on. Qi, and excuse me for being fairly brief on this, Qi is our energy currency. It's what we use in our day-to-day activities. It's what is making me talk up here and making you guys listen, hopefully. And it's what we're doing day-to-day. When we do Qi cultivation, we're taking in Qi on that level. When we have enough of that and we start to develop a surplus, it's put into the bank, is a good way to put it. It's sort of solidified, put into another form called essences, and stored for a rainy day or a time when we get sick and we need a little extra chi. Then we have a reserve in the bank account. Once we have enough chi and we've got a good bank account, then anything left over, or if we continue cultivating, it turns into spirit. And that is, spirit's not a great word because it has so many meanings for so many people in different traditions and so forth, but it's that higher part of ourself. It's the least tangible. It's what allows us to become spiritual beings, perhaps. So that's just a little bit about what essence is qi and spirit.
So I have a question about if qi is depleted, then that's where these things like the shaking and the padding and stuff come in?
That's right. That is one example. The methods of treatment, these are methods of treating ourselves for illness or imbalance. And so there are many illnesses, imbalances that come from yin-yang relationships and qi and so forth, and don't really have time to get into that. But whether it's healing sounds, cultivating qi, patting the body or shaking it, it is to harmonize yin and yang and qi within us as human beings. That's why we're doing those things. Or to build it up and cultivate it.
How would you say what's the relationship between yin and yang and qi?
The relationship between yin and yang and qi?
How do they
fit together?
Yeah.
Well, I can't really... That would take me well beyond the end of the talk, and I've got a few other things to cover here, so...
One quick question about the bank account. Is that the bones, by chance?
The bank account traditionally is in the lower dantian, the kidney function of the body.
The kidneys.
Yeah, and the kidneys oversee bones and bone marrow. So again, now we're getting into Chinese medicine, and we better not go there too far. Okay, I got a couple of other things to talk about here. This is the world, this 2, 3, and 10,000 things is the world of the I Ching, or the classic of changes, which is the philosophical basis of classical Chinese culture, the origin 3 to 5,000 years ago. Older views, I'll just read this. Older views attribute the I Ching to Fu Shi. He's mythical. His date is about 2800 BC. Modern view places it closer to only 3,000 years old. The meaning of the I Ching. Yi as an adjective means easy or simple. As a verb, it means to change or to substitute one thing for another. Jing is a classic text. So, and that classic text is derived from the original meaning of Jing, which is regularity or persistency. So again, look, you're just getting a little idea of the richness of a word. So Yi Jing, as well as being the book of changes or the classic of changes, contains the idea of simplicity, the diverse and changing nature of things, and the persistency of an underlying principle. So it's simple, it is diverse and changing, and yet amongst that diversity and constant change is an underlying principle that does not change. So all that is contained in the meaning of the two words Yi Jing, referring to the book of changes. And it tells something about what the book is about. Chinese traditional practitioners, what are we talking about here? The definition that we're going to give is those practitioners of China's traditional arts, medicine, calligraphy, martial arts, music, painting, all these things, who were born and educated prior to 1949, which is the beginning of the People's Republic of China, when the communists took over. So a traditional practitioner, for our understanding here, is somebody who was trained in their art before the communist era in China. This places most traditional practitioners, all that are left in China, in their 80s and 90s at this point. Most of them do not have students. They have been very marginalized over the past 100 years. I'm going to try and get that in here before we have to close down. They're disappearing fast. And this, to me, this comes around to why I would like you guys to see this video of Dr. Xie. Because he's a very good example of one of these traditional practitioners who pretty much do not exist anymore. And he has a very different view and way of looking at things than a more modern practitioner of medicine, of martial arts, would. There are just not too many ways of seeing these guys or seeing their view anymore. And fortunately, one of his lectures was taped, and that's what you know, really this is all about. Getting a little window into another era of a vanished time in China, and something that unfortunately is mostly lost. Dr. Xie himself and other experts believe there are between 500 and 1,000 of these traditional practitioners left in China today. This is in a country of 1.4 billion people. So very, very few. They're almost all gone. Most of them are just not even known. It's very unfortunate. But this is what it is. As I say, referring to all of China's cultural arts, but specifically more specifically the old doctors, because the doctors, the modernists, consider Chinese medicine to be a prime example of the old ways. And the nationalists first, and then the communists really worked hard to get rid of all the old ways in China. The doctors were particularly gone after because they were fairly defenseless, and their art really exemplified the old view, the old ways of China. Martial artists, for instance, were more respected in society and more feared, and were given a wider berth. They were not executed, sent to the hinterlands, or marginalized quite as much. These people, these old practitioners, were much more likely to be educated in a knowledge lineage, meaning rather than a school and classroom kind of education, although that did exist, they were more likely taught by a single teacher that they spent a large amount of time with. And, you know, why would you want to pass on knowledge like this? There are benefits and there are problems with it. The benefits were that you started with somebody who was an amazing person and they had a lot of knowledge and they spent their whole lives trying to learn and gain more. And then they went and they found a student. And they had to find a student who was also going to be one of these remarkable people. And then they taught everything that they knew to that student, hopefully at a young enough age, that they would then continue to practice, learn more, add more things that fit to the art. And then they would find the next generation person. And so in an illiterate society, this was a way of passing on knowledge and increasing knowledge and keeping it pure. A downside to that, I mean, that's all very good. A downside is, though, that it also kept it quite secret. Because oftentimes each teacher would only find one or maybe a couple people to pass it on to. So the knowledge was maintained, increased, and really held pure, but very few people had access to it or could benefit from it directly. So the fact that Dr. Xie, at the end of his life, there were circumstances that I think are covered in the video that led to this, he lost his student who he had trained completely. He finished with somebody, spent 30 years with him, finished his job, retired. 2 years later, that guy was dead, unfortunately. Dr. Xie was too old to find another student. He didn't have another one far enough along to continue with. So he changed. At the same time, he started meeting Westerners, learning about the West, finding that there were people interested in his art, and he decided to completely open it up, to do an about-face, to start teaching publicly and openly to anybody that would come and learn from him, not waste his time, as he put it, so that hopefully some of his knowledge, which he felt was very valuable and would be lost, would be carried on in many hands rather than, you know, just one that would have it all. So that was very good thinking on his part.
Were there any other of those old lineage people that
There probably are. You know, and I'm not specifically aware of too many. But there, some of these people do have students. Some of them are getting their knowledge passed on. But first, the nationalists, when they came into China, and we'll very quickly go over the timeline here. When the nationalists came in, they first just wanted to ignore the old. So they didn't actively go after it, but they encouraged modernization and putting aside these old-fashioned things. When the communists came in, and especially later during the Cultural Revolution, they went actively after destroying the old knowledge. So it was very difficult times for these people to thrive and bring along a student, but some did. And so there are some people out there carrying on some of these traditions.
Most of the traditional practitioners in Taiwan or mainland.
Probably some of each, and I actually don't know the answer to that question. Some of each, you know, and maybe some in Taiwan are thriving more because they didn't, you know, have the communists going after them.
San Francisco has a pretty lively Chinese culture that supports teachers, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But they're much more modern practitioners, meaning people who were educated after the communist era, meaning much less likely to come out of one of these knowledge lineages, more likely to be taught the standard school kind of teaching. Briefly, I differentiate between classical Chinese medicine, which is this older style, many lineages, many different styles and traditions, diverse, versus, ironically, what's called TCM, or traditional Chinese medicine, which came about between the 1950s and the early 1970s, and is a very standardized method of Chinese medicine that's now taught in schools and colleges in the United States and China. So it's sort of a subset. It's a limited representation of Chinese medicine, and it's actually very hard to find a traditional practitioner who can teach you what they know. You know, as well as being old, grumpy, and so on, they're very highly skilled. They're not the least bit interested, may not even know how to teach a beginner. They're only interested in teaching people who already have a pretty high level of knowledge and who will really work hard. You study with one of them, there's no guarantee that they're going to give you anything. They're very difficult to learn from. So there are a lot of reasons that they don't have very many students, and that most of the stuff is more modern these days. And when you see, I hope you all come back for the video of Dr. Xie, it's much more evident when you hear it directly from him. So let's look quickly, and I think we will end it here, at the final page on the notes, the China's history of the last 150 years. The backdrop of the 1800s in China is the increasing decay of the Qing Dynasty court. This is the end of the imperial era in China. Its loss of political power and general security of the country. The final 100 years of Qing rule, was marked by increasing in foreign imperialism and internal corruption. So at the top of the notes on the left-hand side, we begin with the Opium Wars, 1840 and 1856, approximately. There were a couple of them. And I'll read from the notes. The Opium Wars, the Western powers, primarily England, others as well, you know, they had all made inroads into China. They were trading there. They were trying to carve out what they called spheres of influence, trying to, you know, do what they did, colonize it a little bit. But they were buying things from China. China only had exports. China wasn't buying anything from them. So Western capital was flowing into China. Chinese capital was not coming out of China. They decided the solution to this was to addict the Chinese population to opium and then control the supply and sell it to them. And they managed to do this. The Chinese themselves had to be involved for this to happen, and they were. And the eventual level of corruption that this entailed led to several peasant-based rebellions, including what are called the Opium Wars, and later on the Boxer Rebellion. In the 1870s, after these wars and conflict had been going on for a while, increased foreign intervention. You know, once foreign powers got a hold of this opium supply, the Chinese powers started becoming a little more complacent, the foreign nations came in more and more. The first Chinese-Japanese War continued the deterioration of the Qing power structure. 1900, the Boxer Rebellion. This was a internal anti-foreign, anti-imperialist movement aimed at the Qing rulers, the dynasty rulers, who were embracing the West and going along with them more and more. So they actually stormed the imperial city. They didn't get inside it. They might have had not this eight-nation group come in to save the Qing dynasty along the way, humiliating them, requiring payment for security, and demanding unequal trade treaties, really flexing their muscle at having saved them from this invasion from within. All this led to the fall of the Qing dynasty in 1911. the rise of the nationalists, the Republic of China, Sun Yat-sen, Chiang Kai-shek, new focus on modernizing and leaving the old behind. In 1920, Dr. Xiepeqi was born. So he was born shortly after the fall of the Jing Dynasty. All through this time, you know, tremendous turmoil and uproar in China. In 1928, the nationalists declared Chinese medicine as illegal, saying it's old, it's folk medicine, it's illegal. They just made it illegal. This led to no regulation of Chinese medicine and an increase in itinerant medical charlatans, to put it in Dr. Xie's language. Once it was no longer regulated, you know, anybody could hang up a shingle. And people did. They were not shy. A lot of people took advantage of that situation. Second Japanese invasion in 1931, followed by the second Chinese-Japanese War. This one started in 1937, actually merged into World War II. It was just before the beginning of this war that Dr. Xie started studying with his master, Men Baozhen.
Where was he?
In Beijing. They were all in Beijing. After World War II and the Japanese-Chinese War had wound down, the Japanese basically kicked butt in that one. Civil war within China. The nationalists were becoming weaker, and the communists came along and challenged them. Close to 10 years of civil war before the communists prevailed, and the People's Republic of China, or Communist China, was initiated in 1949. Dr. Xie was 29 years old at that point. So he had been studying since age 14. He had completed a good bit of his education prior to this time. That's what I'm pointing out here. Seats him as a traditional practitioner. Shortly thereafter, well, actually the later 50s, first active campaigns against the rightists, the landowners, the bourgeois. 1958 to 1961. This is really amazing, and we'll finish it up here. What Mao called the Great Leap Forward, what everybody else called 3 years catastrophe, up to 30 million people died of starvation in China between 1958 and 1961. In contrast, California population in 1996 was 36 million. In 3 years, almost as many people as live in California today died of starvation in China. This is because of dictates that Mao and the Chinese government put out. I won't go into the history of that. Dr. Xie is 38 years old at this time. His teacher dies. Obviously, this Great Leap Forward was quite unpopular. A move was made to oust Mao, and he responded with the Cultural Revolution in 1966. Lasted for 10 years. And this is when they actively went after everything old. This is when the books were burned and the old doctors were killed and sent out to the countryside. This was a very bad time for all things traditional. And it was also the time that Chinese medicine and acupuncture and other arts were made to look more Western. So maps of the acupuncture points and meridians were placed over physiological charts of the organs, and they started talking in non-traditional terms. It was also during this time that the Chinese government decided what was going to be traditional Chinese medicine and laid that out. After the Cultural Revolution, a period of recovery for a few years, leading to economic change, and the beginning of the emergence of a market economy. This was all an extremely chaotic period. During this time, there was very little education of any kind going on in China this time. Very few people were being trained in any arts. 1984 on, growth towards capitalism. Into the 1990s, serious capitalism, people with money coming into China, commercialization of Chinese medicine along with everything else. And we're well aware of that. As Benny was mentioning to me earlier today, almost everything we buy nowadays comes from China. It was in the 1990s that Dr. Xie started teaching in the West and opening up his system, and he finally passed away in 2003. So, in conclusion, So I can, I'm over time here a minute, but, and these guys need to close up after me. We can see that China's traditional practitioners managed to carry on somehow, the ones that did, through incredibly difficult times and conditions. You know, it's hard to practice these things today. The practices are not so hard, but finding the time to put in your time, develop gong fu or skill in these. You know, it's hard for us. We're all busy. It was 100 times harder for these people because they didn't have, you know, a fraction of what we had. They had a government that was, you know, trying to put them down and quell all these things. And yet they felt strongly enough to keep it going in some way, shape, or form. Also, another important thing here and why this is dying out is that the environment that created these practitioners no longer exists in China. That's gone for good. And it's really a shame. These people have become cultural artifacts for the most part, and most of their information has been lost. It's really like thousands of years of a cultural tradition that in span of 50 years especially and 100 years more generally is gone now. There are little pockets of it, which is fortunate. And some of it comes along. But this is what's happened. There are small efforts underway to try and preserve some of the knowledge, even if it's only academic. So there are people studying the few of the doctors. Even the communist government made an attempt in 1990 to assign students to some of these traditional practitioners that they could identify. But that really didn't work out. It just, again, the environment wasn't there for the training. The students that were designated didn't have what it took to really, you know, take it on. And so there are very few of them left. Fortunately, we do have Dr. Xie as one and a few others, as I say, who are being documented to preserve some of this knowledge. Dr. Xie has great stuff for us as people today, and that will come forth a bit in the video, because he'll talk about his practices, he'll practice a little bit with the audience, and you'll get to see a little bit more of who he was, you know, what is it to be a person like him. So I hope that I haven't tried to cover too much here and that this has been of some interest and use for you. And I think that it will allow you to see and understand a little bit more about where Dr. Xie is coming from right off the bat, because they don't go into that. They go directly into him talking about the topic, which is healing without medicines. So we continue with that video the next two Wednesdays at the same time here.
Wednesday?
Next Wednesday and the following Wednesday rather than Thursdays. You can see either one separately. If you can only pick one, it's probably better to see the first half and you'll get the introduction and not kind of jump into the middle of it. So, thank you all for coming. I'm sorry for taking a little bit over time, but turn it back over to you.
I just want to say that I've had a chance to see the first video. David loaned it to me. It's really amazing. If you have a chance to see it, it's extraordinary. Dr. Xie, is that right?
Yes.
Very direct, very clear. He is absolutely soaked to the marrow in this tradition. They're like, and it just emanates, you know, from him. So if you get a chance to come to the video, you know, like, I would encourage you to do so. Many Rivers Books and Tea also is having two tea tastings this Saturday and a week from this Saturday here at the store at 3 p.m. You know, like, so if you're interested in the tea aspect of our store, you'll get to sample a bunch of teas for free, you know, like, and they're a lot of fun, you know, like, so I encourage you to look at that. And finally, Many Rivers Books and Tea has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. There's a donation bowl on the counter. A portion of the donation goes to David to support his work. A portion goes to the store so that we can continue to have events here on Thursday evening, or Wednesday evening, or whatever evening the case may be. thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you. And I'd like to mention that the any portion of that money that comes to me is going to be going directly to Dr. Shin's family. So we will actually support his family.